Good morning. We have three cases scheduled for oral argument. All counsel in those cases have finally arrived, and we understand everyone has announced ready and declared the time that they wish to take for their argument. That being the case, we'll call Kim Hackler versus Nicholas DePinto et al.
May it please the court, my name is Myrna Silver, and I'm here on behalf of Kim Hackler, Steve Hackler, and the estate of Christopher Hackler. The trial court in this case improperly...
Ms. Silver, were you aware of the 9 o'clock schedule?
I certainly was, Your Honor. I apologize. I was downstairs at the entrance of the courtroom, to the courthouse at about a quarter till 9, and the security check with taking off of shoes and so on took an excessive amount of time, and I apologize for getting up here late.
Apology accepted. Just try to be more prompt next time you
Thank
appear.
Thank you. Okay. The trial court improperly granted summary judgment as to all defendants in this case for a myriad of reasons. First of all, the order granting summary judgment did not state the basis on which summary judgment was granted. And shortly before arguments were made, the summary judgment arguments were made, appellant filed a fourth amended complaint or petition, and we alleged the cause of action of a strict liability. At the time that we had the hearing, on the motions for summary judgment, the court would not even address the new cause for strict liability and specifically said that if anybody wanted to amend or change their pleadings and plead it later, they could. So the court was well aware that there were some additional allegations or an additional basis for appellant's case.
But isn't strict liability just a standard that's applied, not a whole separate new cause of action?
Yes, ma'am. I would certainly agree with that. But again, it was never addressed by the court. It was not addressed by appellees or the defendants in their briefing. The court did not entertain any discussion of it when we had oral argument before the trial court. And again, that's in the transcript before the court. Yet despite that, the court went ahead and granted full summary judgment on all, with respect to all matters to the defendants. So that's our first point of error. The other points of error have to do with the fact that the defendants never pleaded anything and never argued anything except negligence in their briefing. And the standard is absolutely incorrect. Negligence is not the standard when it comes to a private plaintiff and a private defendant. Who's not a media defendant or a public official or somebody of that ilk who might be well known before the public. Where two private parties are involved, strict liability is the standard. Now, strict liability means that once there is proof that the statements were published, and in this case, there is no doubt that there was a publication of the defamatory remarks. They were published repeatedly, in fact, because the children who are involved here gave statements to their teacher. They gave statements to the principal. They gave sworn statements to the police officer on the campus of the school. And over again, their versions of their stories changed. That were further embellished each time, except for one, and that was Laurel Glenn. Laurel Glenn, in fact, as her statements went along, began to recant what she had said in her previous statements. So we have internal inconsistencies among these children's own statements that renders them untruthful. So there's no doubt that the statements were defamatory, that they were not truthful. The statements were made maliciously, and by malice, of course, I'm not referring to the ordinary meaning of the term malice, you know, meaning ill will or something of that sort. I'm using malice in the sense of with knowledge of the falsity or with reckless disregard for the truth, which is how malice applies in defamation cases. Not only that, but Christopher Hackler was was injured, as it was defamation per se in this case, because he was injured with respect to his general reputation in the community. The evidence clearly shows that after this whole episode, he changed schools, was allowed to change schools, and there is ample evidence that after that there was a downward spiral. In his case, he was already suffering from mild depression, which was comorbid with his attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and his depression worsened. He and his family had problems remaining in the community because of all of this, all these silly allegations by the students who, on one hand, just as an example how silly they are, one of the children involved here said he threatened to put curses and spells on me, and it scared me. And then in his deposition, that same student said, and this is in the summary judgment evidence, I knew he couldn't do that. I knew it wasn't true. So what prompted this child to bring charges of terroristic threats against Christopher Hackler when he knew that these statements, if they had been made at all, regarding putting curses and spells on children could not have possibly meant anything.
How is it that you contend that the statements were published?
The students published them by, first of all, telling their teacher about them verbally, then writing a written statement for the teacher, then writing a written statement for the assistant principal in some cases. If they're told to a third party, third parties outside, so to speak, the small group of children, that's a publication. At any rate, there was no truth in any of these children's statements. They all contradicted each other in terms of the facts. None of them substantiated the other. Travis Wheeler, one of the children, as far as his credibility is concerned, in his deposition, the fact came out that he had a MySpace webpage and admitted on his MySpace webpage, he said he was 28 years old when he was about 16 at the time. And when asked why he said he was 28 in his MySpace webpage, he said without a blink, you have to be 18 to have a MySpace webpage. So he thought nothing about lying over just about this silly web page, and he was 16 at the time. We can only imagine what his idea of speaking the truth was when he was 12 or 13 years old at the time of these incidents. With respect to the McBride child, Ashley McBride, her story changed constantly. Every time she wrote a different statement, either by telling the teacher, by reporting to the principal, by writing her sworn statement for the police officer, her story changed, became more embellished, facts were added. We have no idea which is the truthful version, if any.
Didn't Chris Hackler concede that he made several of the statements? How can you say if any?
No, ma'am, not exactly. He conceded that he may have said something like what Ashley McBride at any rate stated, but that was the only thing he admitted to. He never admitted to anything that Laurel Glenn.
But aren't the statements that Ashley attributed to him the most egregious statements?
He never admitted that he said those things. He said that he may have said something like some of what she said, just to keep her away from him.
I don't understand the distinction you're drawing. I mean, if he said something similar, that I don't think that the law requires him to say, I spoke every single word of that statement to make truth be a defense.
Well, the only thing he admitted to is he may have said something about cutting his arm and her drinking his blood. She went on to talk about cutting her hair and sewing it up with her own hair. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and the casting of curses and spells and so on. Christopher, in effect, was being bullied by these children in this class. There is a statement that's in evidence where Travis Wheeler describes that when Chris came over and tried to sit next to them in class, they got up en masse and moved away from him. I mean, for a 12 or 13-year-old, this is absolutely devastating. He just wanted to keep them away and was making these statements for that purpose. Ashley McBride
What summary judgment evidence is there rebutting the defense, the affirmative defense of substantial truth?
What summary judgment is there?
What summary judgment evidence is in the record rebutting the affirmative defense of substantial truth?
Okay, there is lots of evidence, Your Honor. First of all, the various statements that the children made, first of all, with Ashley McBride, changed over time. Travis Wheeler's statement or Ashley's statement with respect to the fact that Chris rubbed Travis Wheeler on the head. Travis Wheeler denied that Chris ever touched him. With respect to the statement by Laurel Glenn that she heard Chris make these statements directly, then over time her statements changed. She heard it through a third party. She overheard it. These children's own statements are internally inconsistent show that there's no substantial truth to their statements. We don't know where the truth of these statements begins or ends based on these children's statements. That's where the substantial truth is not met in this case.
Ms. Silver, was there any challenge to your authority to actually sue the minors in the court below?
No, Your Honor, there has not been. with respect to damages, the defendants have alleged that we have not proven damages. If a strict liability standard applies, and although the Texas Supreme Court hasn't spoken to that issue, there have been several cases by courts of appeal in this state, notably in the case of Peshack v. Greer, a strict liability standard applies. We don't need to prove damages, but even if we did, damages have been proven. There's over 150 pages of evidence in the record regarding the nearly 2 years Chris spent in various psychiatric and substance abuse treatment centers. That was a direct result of this whole affair. The family was forced to move out of state. They couldn't stay in the community. They went back to Oklahoma, where they were from. The parents divorced. All of this had an influence on and was a direct causation of Chris's downhill mental spiral that caused him to end up for a year and a half in these various treatment centers, therapeutic boarding schools, and so on. I mean, this is an absolute sorry mess brought about by some silly, absolutely silly statements by 12-year-old children who were simply verbally bullying a classmate that they didn't like. If this kind of case is allowed to go on if the defendants are allowed to escape without liability here. It just opens a Pandora's box of allowing all kinds of gossip to go around the community, damage people's reputations without any kind of recompense or any kind of liability on the part of the those who would defame somebody. And this just has to be stopped at this point, and some kind of lesson must be taught to people who need to think before they go and make these allegations. Now, as far as the parents are concerned, I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Silver. Mr. Smith.
That pleases the court. My name is Kobe Smith, and I represent Laurel Glenn and her parents. With me today at counsel's table is Greg Ave, who represents Nicholas DePinto and his parents. Also today we have David Stewart and Randy Hall, who represent Travis Wheeler and their parents, and Ashley McBride and her parents. I will be addressing some of the substantive issues, such as substantial truth, the privileges defenses, and damages, time permitting. Mr. Ave, if I have time, I'm going to let Mr. Ave have some time to discuss the procedural issue relating to the strict liability claim and whether that was a new cause of action or whether it was unaddressed and whether error was preserved.
What would be, in your opinion, the threshold issue that we would need to consider at the outset? Would it be the qualified immunity or qualified privilege, or would it be substantial truth? What comes first?
To me, the easiest. I think there's several different ways to affirm this summary judgment. I think the easiest is the judicial privilege, because nobody has questioned that Officer Mayhew conducted a criminal investigation into this matter. And, in fact, Chris was charged with criminal charges as a result of this investigation. And the Texas cases clearly hold that the very first statement is oftentimes the beginning of the process of a judicial proceeding, and that first statement or that first complaint deserves the same protection as if that statement was made in the courtroom. So I think that right there, you could stop and say, we affirm the trial court summary judgment on that basis alone. I also think you can affirm it on the evidence of damages issue, because damages are an essential element of a defamation claim.
Well, if there's a bar to suit, we wouldn't reach the damages issue.
No, I agree, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is I think you can almost treat these separately, and each one standing on its own, each defense or each theory of law on its own is sufficient to support the trial court summary judgment, whether it be the judicial immunity or the judicial privilege for making a complaint that led to a judicial proceeding, or whether it be the fact that they did not present any evidence of damages, which is an essential element of their claim. Even the case that they rely upon doesn't support their argument regarding strict liability. The case they rely upon is a liable per se defamation case, and as discussed in the briefing, this is not a liable per se or a defamation per se case.
And is it true that all of the statements that are in question here were given by the students at the direction of their teachers, school administrators, and police? Is that correct? And that's the only persons that those statements were directed to, as far as the record reflects.
As far as the record reflects, and as far as I know, that's the only persons those statements were directed to by these individuals. There's been allegations that this was common knowledge in the community. I'm not aware of anything in the record that indicates that. And the points you just made, I think, is very important to consider in looking at the substantial truth argument. These were 12 and 13-year-old kids who approached a teacher after she had taken Mr. Hackler to the principal's office and expressed concerns about other things that had been going on. The teacher instructed them, write it down. They did that on notebook paper. That same day, some of them were called to the principal's office. I think some of them may have been called to the principal's office the next day. They were then instructed to write it down on witness statement forms. And ultimately, they were the four of the defendants that are involved in this case, and two of the six who were not sued in this case provided sworn statements to Officer Mayhew. And with respect to the substantial truth defense, I think it's important to consider, and I think Justice Walker pointed out, that it doesn't have to, he doesn't have to acknowledge, yes, I said word for word these things. You look at the gist or the overall impact of the statements. And if the court will take a look at not just these four individual statements, but there were six other individuals who made statements in this case. And those six individual statements are located in the record at 434 to 444. If you look at all 10 of these students' statements, there's a very common thread running through as far as what's going on. If you look at Chris Hackler's admissions as to what he did, he didn't just admit to the comments about cutting himself and having Ashley McBride drink his blood. He did admit, you know, making something similar to that. But he also admitted to making shocking statements to Travis Wheeler. His mom admitted that he had told her he had done some of these things. If you look at the big picture in this case, the substantial truth defense also applies just as judicial privilege and in the no evidence of damages case. Look at the big picture. Every statement doesn't have to be true. It just has to have an overall gist of what actually happened. And if you compare the statements with what Chris Hackler himself has admitted to doing, the overall gist is the same thing. And there's certainly no evidence that the gist of these statements caused more damage in the community than what Chris Hackler himself has admitted to. Now, I do want to leave some time, unless there's questions, I do want to leave some time for Mr. Ave to discuss his arguments.
I have a procedural question. Would the defendants as well as the plaintiff request that initials be used for the juveniles' names in any opinion issued by this court?
I honestly haven't thought of that, Your Honor, but I certainly, you know, as you posed it, I think that would probably be a good idea unless somebody else objects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Ave?
Thank you, Your Honors. As Mr. Smith indicated, I represent the DePinto family, but as we've divided it up, I'm going to attempt to address very briefly in the time remaining the procedural aspect, which is, as I see it, the primary argument, the first argument launched by the appellant's brief, and that is that they alleged a new cause of action with their Fourth Amendment petition for strict liability defamation claim, and that the failure of the motions for summary judgment filed by the appellees to specifically address those allegations in and of itself requires this court to reverse not just the summary judgment as to the strict liability claim, but the appellants argue to this court that the entire summary judgment has to be reversed on that ground.
Would the strict liability claim also be barred by the quasi-judicial privilege?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I agree with what I would call the sequencing of the arguments is the question posed by Your Honor to Mr. Smith goes, I believe that fundamentally the context in which these statements were made is the overriding concern and issue in this case, that when you step back and look at it, the notion that when students are asked to write something down by their teacher, instructed by their principal to write something down, and instructed by a police officer to write something down, I think there's a serious question of whether, in fact, there's any type of publication, and it's interlocked with this issue of whether or not it benefits from immunity as a whole. But turning to the procedural aspect, if there are no other questions on that, with respect to this strict liability claim, first and foremost, of course, this isn't a separate cause of action. This cause of action or this standard of care is a rule which potentially applies to this claim. I would argue strongly it does not apply because this is not a private matter. It's not remotely a private matter. And anyone who thinks that these type of things said by somebody or allegedly said by somebody in a school context should be considered a private matter, I don't think is using common sense. But if we look at what that standard is, that they don't have to prove knowledge of the falsity, it is simply one element which is taken away, if you will, or watered down from the traditional sense of defamation. And in this instance, all the defendants moved for summary judgment and defeated the other elements of defamation, which in and of itself means that this cause of action isn't separate and distinct, but rather is part and parcel of the defamation claim itself. It is, in essence, defamation light, if you will, if it in fact applies, which I don't think it does. The second issue is whether or not there's any issue preserved for this court to even look at this issue. And if the court will review the responses filed by the appellants, which are at 639 as to the DePintos, 604 as to the Glens, 660 as to the Wheelers, and 693 as to the McBrides, the court will not find one word, utterance, or suggestion that there is a defect in the motion for summary judgment. What there is in oral argument, a suggestion that there was a continuance requested as to this. Of course, the defendants didn't ask for a continuance. And in fact, if the court looks at the continuance, which is found at page 740 of the record, there is, of course, no mention of this notion. So in this instance, the trial court was not afforded an opportunity to, quote unquote, see this purported defect and fix it. It was not complained of as a grounds for opposing the motion for summary judgment or an objection to the motion for summary judgment. The fact that the plaintiffs may have orally wanted to continue the summary judgment hearing, a 166AG type motion, doesn't have anything to do with preserving error for appeal. The last issue, of course, is, again, kind of stepping back to the broader issue, and that is Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 44-1A1. And that is, let's assume for a moment that this strict liability claim is its own independent cause of action. And let's assume for a moment that it applies, and let's assume for a moment that they preserve this error, none of which is the case. Can they show harmful or reversible error? And the answer, of course, this dovetails back with the original argument, is absolutely they cannot, because all the summary judgments addressed and defeated the elements of defamation in sequence. And therefore, if we didn't address something on a claim which really isn't an independent claim, but if it is and shares three out of the four elements of defamation in a broader context, and we defeated those three elements, and those elements are shared by this cause of action, then it's essentially over. And again, I think it's important to see the with respect to the preservation and this appeal is on the whole as to how I think the Hackler's brief is misguided. And I would point the court to all of the reply briefs, but specifically to the reply brief I'm going to read from the DePinto reply brief, and that is page 2. In the order granting summary judgment, the summary judgment motions, it granted, speaking of the trial court, only a general summary judgment, which, while not specifically specifying, the ground on which it was granted, in violation of Rule 166A. Here, because no ground was stated by the district court, in its order granting the DePinto, Glenn, McBride, and Wheeler motions for summary judgment, this case should be remanded because there is no way to know what theories were relied on by the trial court. Page 3, exact same argument of the reply brief. Of course, quote, of course, because the court, referring to the trial court, never stated any basis for its decision in rendering a, quote, unquote, general summary judgment decision, we cannot know whether or not reversible error did or did not occur. That is why this case should be remanded to the trial court on its merits. That's the essence of their argument, which is fundamentally inconsistent with Texas law. When summary judgment is granted and the grounds are not specified, this court and every appellate court in the state and the Supreme Court knows and says repeatedly, any grounds asserted in the motions which can support judgment as a matter of law can and should be used as a basis for affirming the summary judgment. It is on these grounds that Mr. Smith discussed and the grounds that I discussed that the appellees respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court's judgment in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Avi. Ms. Silver, do you have rebuttal?
Yes, I'd like to address the quasi-judicial argument that was brought by the appellees. This quasi-judicial argument opens a Pandora's box. Basically, it says that any statement by any private citizen to the police, for example, in bringing a complaint would be subject to this quasi-judicial protection. This means that people could simply go around, as they did in this case, make any allegations they wanted to the police, however wild, or unsubstantiated, and those statements would be completely protected by this so-called quasi-judicial argument. That's not the point of the quasi-judicial statement. There was nothing quasi-judicial about the initial statements that the students gave to their teacher. There was absolutely no thought at that point that there was going to be any kind of litigation or accusations or criminal charges arising out of any of this. If the adults involved here had not been severed from the case, we would have a better view of what went on there, but unfortunately, we don't. There was no quasi-judicial aspect. There was no thought of any kind of charges being brought at the time the children gave statements to the administrators at the school. To say that those were quasi-judicial statements, completely misses the mark. With respect to the statements they gave to school resource officer, the quasi-judicial protection doesn't mean that people can simply state any wild complaint against somebody else and have it protected by this quasi-judicial argument.
I have a question for you about a statement in your reply brief.
I'm sorry, a statement?
In your reply brief?
Yes, ma'am.
In your reply brief, you say, talking about the substantial truth, that as an affirmative defense, it is not an element of plaintiff's case, and it was not necessary for appellant to raise it in appellant's brief. Is that still your position?
Yes, ma'am. If it's an affirmative defense, then the appellant bear the burden of proof.
So it's your position.
The appellees, I'm sorry.
I understood what you're saying. So it's your position, then, that you had no burden to refute that in your brief?
Yes, ma'am. Okay. And again, the statement that this was not a private matter, I really take issue with that. This didn't involve the media, didn't involve any public officials, didn't involve anybody who was prominent in the community. If this is not a private matter, I don't know what is. Finally, the very fact that the students were instructed to write something down by their teacher does not make this a quasi-judicial, doesn't give the statements quasi-judicial status, excuse me. And the arguments of the appellees ignored the fact that these statements were untruthful to begin with, that they were defamatory per se, and they are pinning their hopes simply on procedural aspects in order to avoid any consequences for this, quite frankly, sorry mess of a case. Thank you.
Court appreciates all counsel appearing here this morning to make your arguments. Particularly those who appeared on time. And the case is submitted, and we'll ask the clerk to recess us until we have a panel substitution change.